But first, when Julia Gillard overthrew Kevin Rudd, she promised in her first press conference to re-prosecute the case for putting a price on carbon. Across the Tasman today marks an important day in that score, New Zealand introducing an emissions trading scheme today. This week, in this country, 1,000 scientists are meeting on the Gold Coast at a major international conference focusing specifically on adaptation to climate change. Chris Field is the director of the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution for Science in the United States. He's also one of the co-chairs of the next IPCC reports on climate change, due in 2013. I'm pleased to say Chris will be speaking at the conference later today and is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, James.
Is it the dominant scientific view at this conference that dangerous climate change is here now, and that means while reducing emissions remains important, attention must now turn to adaptation?
There's no doubt that we've seen important changes in climate almost everywhere in the world over the last several decades, and there's no doubt that there's a real need for people to adapt to the changes that have already occurred and to changes that we expect in the future.
And what do we mean when we talk about adaptation?
Adaptation can be a wide range of strategies for helping people and ecosystems cope with climate changes. It can range from financial approaches, purchasing insurance, to physical construction, things like building seawalls, or it can even involve moving activities.
Moving Earth?
Not so much moving people. Well, in some cases, it's moving people. There are many villages in Alaska and the U.S. that have opted to move away from coastal areas. In some cases, it's shifting areas of agricultural production.
And one can begin to conceive the cost of not adapting from what you've said there.
Yeah. In general, there are costs of adapting, and adaptation makes sense when the costs of adapting are attractive relative to the costs of not adapting.
And given these costs will be borne by governments, it will inherently be a political and controversial exercise, one perhaps not suited to the task at hand.
Well, adaptation is implemented at many different levels. In contrast to mitigation, many of the decisions about adaptation and many of the funding mechanisms are local or even at the individual level. Purchasing insurance is a good example, but some of them are at the scale of government decisions, things like seawalls, for example.
What you mentioned insurance for individuals, explain that, and what other methods individuals can take to adapt?
Well, there are many kinds of decisions at the individual level. One example is insurance. Another example is equipping your home to be comfortable in a wide range of temperatures, additional home insulation, things like white roofs, things like just having a network of friends that you can contact if conditions are getting too hot and you need a cool place to go.
As with all things in this world, resources are distributed unevenly. I expect then the adaptation response will be unevenly distributed as well. What are the implications of that going to be?
One of the things that we look for is trying to identify the individuals and the parts of the world where adaptation capacity is limited and find mechanisms, sometimes international, sometimes national, sometimes local, in order to enhance adaptation capacity in the places where it's most necessary. And in general, the need for adaptation is greatest in the communities and the people who have the most trouble dealing with a wide range of issues. It's often the elderly, the poor, or the ill.
And the next UN climate meeting, climate change conference, will be taking place at Mexico at the end of this year. In the lead-up to Copenhagen, there was a great deal of political will from all over the globe, but then very little was ultimately actually achieved. What lessons have been learned from that? Are you concerned the political will has gone?
Well, in the IPCC, we focus on providing stakeholders, decision-makers, with the best available scientific information. And I'm confident that we have done as good a job as we can, and I'm optimistic that the world's leaders will increasingly be in a position in order to make smart decisions about dealing with climate change.
And yet there was the controversy that must be overcome by the IPCC from their faulty glacier and other predictions.
The IPCC has an outstanding record of providing credible, useful scientific information. Its last report was not completely error-free, and we are working hard to ensure that in the future the reports are as close to error-free as is humanly possible.
And indeed, isn't the IPCC, in acquiring its experts to produce these reports, taking a more broad approach?
We just in the last couple of weeks have released the names of the author teams for the next assessment. We're very excited that we've got an exceptional international group, very broad-based, very richly representative of Australians, I should add.
The debate about the merits of an ETS, an emissions trading scheme, are continuing. According to a study commissioned by a group called the Skeptical Environmentalist, it says the EU plans to fight climate change until 2020, and that will cost hundreds of billions of dollars but give scant benefits. I guess what I'm asking is, do you believe an ETS is the best way to put a price on carbon, or do you see a direct carbon tax as more effective?
You know, in the IPCC, it's really important that we not be policy prescriptive. We provide the background for each of the relevant policies. We provide the costs and the benefits. And then we ask the stakeholders, the governments, and the communities to make decisions about the approaches that they want to pursue.
Chris Field, thank you for being with us this morning. Good luck with your conference.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
And Chris Field, the Director of the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution for Science in the United States. 8:13.